This is November 10th, 2006, an interview with Commander Herb Harzan, conducted by Tani Gutterson at the University of Victoria. So first, Mr. Harzan, when did you join the Navy and why did you decide to join the military?
Okay, I joined in September of 1961, and why? Mostly during my high school years, I was looking for university education. I had some experience with the Navy through Sea Cadets, been to Sea Cadet camps, been to sea with for short periods with the Navy, and so I had an interest in the Navy specifically, and I was looking at the idea of getting my university education paid for, and at the same time starting a career in something that I might enjoy for the rest of my life, but I might just do my minimum time and then pursue other things.
And when did you retire? How long did you serve till?
I served 36 years. I retired early 1997.
And what made you choose the Navy over the other services? That you're interested in it? Or?
Right. I just indicated during high school and junior high school, I was involved in Sea Cadets in Winnipeg, and they sent me to the coast in a couple of summers where I had experience with the Royal Canadian Navy, going to sea for short periods, and so I had a great interest in the Navy, and whereas I had little or no exposure to the Air Force or the Army at that time, so that's why I chose the Navy.
And what made you choose to become an aviator?
Well, that's actually quite interesting because it's coincidental. When I applied at the recruiting office in Winnipeg during my high school years, there was a selection process where you had to go for interviews locally in Winnipeg, and there were tests and interviews and then also a medical examination to see whether you're medically fit before they would process you further, and then you had a week of further testing in Centralia once you overcame the first hurdles. And I remember so well that having finished my medical, the doctor put a stamp on it and said fit pilot. Up until that point I had never considered becoming a pilot because I sort of thought that it was in some ways too risky as a career move, because if you did not succeed for whatever reason, and as a child I had car sickness concerns, and so I didn't want to put all my eggs into going for a flying career, and I thought there's nothing if it didn't succeed. So I was looking at getting an engineering degree and a naval officer certification. And it was just then when I saw the fit pilot, when I was selected and went to Centralia for the week-long testing before then, I saw that those that were going for pilot had additional tests that fascinated me. And so I demanded that I be included. They said, well, you haven't applied for pilot. And I said, well, I also had not rejected it. I just left that blank. So with some persistence, they did reprogram my testing schedule to include the pilot aspect of it, the C9 tests, the simulator and all that. And I found the love of my life in terms of work. And I abandoned the engineering after that and, pursued flying as my main career.
And how many years did you end up flying for?
Well, I was in the forces for 36 years, and I was always qualified as a pilot for that. And during the 36 years, it was about 20 to 22 that I was in an actual flying position.
Mm-hmm. And before you entered the naval program, what kind of training did you have to do before that? Before the aviation program, sorry.
Yeah, I entered... I initially was planning to go into the ROTP program, but I was still a junior matriculant in Manitoba, and there was a possibility of starting 1 year earlier with a junior matriculation diploma. So I had applied for that. So the idea was for me to get my senior matriculation with the forces, with the Navy, and then proceed to the service colleges for the university degree. As it turned out, after I joined Venture, which was a two-year officer training program, not leading to a degree, but the senior matriculation and then the rest professional training, the flying aspect sort of took over, and I decided not to risk my eyesight for the 4 years of studying at that time, and so I wanted to get flying sooner. So after the 2 years of naval officer training, I then went, still as a naval officer, but to the Royal Canadian Air Force for pilot training, which took a year and gave me my wings, and this was all fixed wing flying at that time. And subsequent to that, I was selected by the Navy to go to the helicopter program, and that training took place at Shearwater, Nova Scotia, in with the Navy. And that was just at the time that Canada had committed to acquiring the Sea Kings and started the concept of small ship operation of helicopters, the DDH program.
And you said that you trained at Shearwater. How long was that one for, the helo training?
Yes, the RCF was basic and advanced fixed wing training, and that with leave, and so it took about a year. And the Shearwater one was about 6 months. And I qualified as a helicopter pilot.
And what aircraft did you train in for both the fixed wing and the helo training?
For the fixed wing, it was the Chipmunk, initially for basic flying training, and then the Expediter for what they call the advanced flying training. And the Chipmunk was in Centralia, Ontario, and the Expediter in Rivers, Manitoba.
What did a typical training day look like?
To finish that last question, yes, on the helicopter side, it was the HTL-6 and the HO-4S3 Sikorsky helicopter, so those were the other two types that I trained on. Okay, sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. What did a typical training day look like if one existed at all?
Well, actually it was somewhat similar between the Air Force and the Navy, the training. You were there primarily for training, so there were very limited other duties involved. It's typical, say, a typical training day, more like a typical training week, where you would have ground school, and some days you'd have ground school, and then intermixed with that was the actual flight training. So you might have a half day of ground school and then take a flight, or you might have a whole day of ground school and have a night flight, or something like that. So it was basically a combination of classroom instructions and in their training. And for that duration, as I said, there was little or no other duties to do. And it was similar in the Navy. There, it was not quite as formal. The squadron that did the basic helicopter training was also a utility squadron with other duties. So there, it was a little less structured, and you did start carrying out duties with the squadron and had, you know, duty officer and other sort of responsibilities besides getting qualified on the helicopter.
Now, was there any survival training at all during the pilot program?
Survival training, yes. Not with the Air Force, so not in basic training. I don't recall any survival training. With the Navy, we did have, it wasn't sort of totally linked with the basic helicopter training. It was just a naval air requirement, and most of us got exposure to the first survival course during training. So it was basically a base or naval air requirement that you do a survival course every few years, and usually the first one was during the time that you're still during the training phase. At Shearwater, there were two types of survival courses at that time. One of them was a land survival course where they had an area in the country of Nova Scotia where you went out for about a week and built emergency shelters and lived more or less off the land with minimum type of things that you had along, basically all what you would normally carry in an aircraft and nothing else. And also there was sort of a shorter duration, 1 or 2 days, I don't remember exactly, of sea survival, which was a separate thing where you had training in survival at sea and, going into the dinghies and the life jackets and all that sort of stuff, and in your immersion suit. So basically getting yourself acquainted with all the equipment that you carried every day when flying over the water, but just give you a practical hands-on experience on how to use it.
And during this time of your first training with the fixed wing and the Hilo, did you ever train with other countries at this time, or did that come in?
No. I was sort of the first generation, I think it was probably 1 year or two before me. The Canadian Navy, the RCN, used to contract with the United States Navy for the pilot training. And then just before my time, it was switched to the Air Force for basic flying training to get wings, the Canadian Air Force, and to the Navy to do the in-house helicopter training. So some of my colleagues took their training with the U.S. Navy, but as I say, in my case, no.
Do you believe that your training prepared you for your future career that was to come?
No, I think so, yes. Yeah. Yes, very much so.
And what kind of training did you have to do to keep your flying current throughout the years?
That's changed a little bit also over the years. When I first started flying in 1964 at Shearwater, the system, I think, both in the Air Force and in the Navy, was that if you were obviously on squadron in a flying position, you had all your requirements to fly. But if you're in a staff position or something else, in order to maintain your flying pay, which was our main interest, you had to have, I believe it was something like 25 hours a quarter or something like that. So it was called proficiency flying. And people in staff positions would be allowed and required to go to squadrons, and usually it was the utility squadrons, and just fly a few trips every quarter and every year to their examination flights, their ticket rides, as we call them. And but that was reviewed over the years, and then for a while it was sort of voluntary, and then it was canceled, and the main reason being costs. They found that the cost of keeping so many people that were not actually in active flying current was far greater than when you move them back into a flying position to give them an intensive refresher and bring them right up to speed. So I actually I was always in flying postings while the proficiency flying program existed, and my only sort of exposure was that I would be you know, the captain of the aircraft, well, some of these staff officers would get there quarterly time, you know, to make sure that somebody who was current was actually in the aircraft. So I never did the proficiency flying aspect.
After finishing your pilot's training, where was your first posting?
It was at Chiller. And it was with HS-50, which is the operational helicopter, anti-submarine helicopter squadron.
And what was your time like at that, during, with that squadron?
What was it like?
Yeah.
It was great. I was a young, inexperienced pilot. Mm-hmm. The squadron was just as I was arriving, switching from HO4's horse, as we commonly call it, helicopters to the Sea Kings. So it was an interesting time because up until that point, helicopters at sea did not fly at night. In fact, our nickname was, as helicopter pilots, was sundowners, because when the sun set, we adjourned to the bar, and, you know, at sea. And then with the Sea King, of course, it was completely certified for instrument and night flying. So it brought a whole new dimension. And that was an interesting thing because all the sort of old timers, if you want to call it, all the people prior to my year going into the helicopter business were a sort of a collections of odds and sods of people that for one reason or another did not stay with the fixed wing program, and with sort of my generation of pilots, it was the first the lead sort of thing of having day night fully instrumented operations conducted in the helicopter sphere. So I think the things were very interesting because all of my sort of supervisor pilots and so they were learning just as, in fact, in some cases I had more experience with instrument flying than they did, because for the previous however many years I'd been flying, they'd only done basically a day visual flying rule operations. Whereas, you know, I was sort of the new breed that was going to take the helicopter world into, you know, unrestricted operations. So that was interesting. But the other thing, of course, that was affecting us, the Sea Kings were just coming online. So, you know, when I joined HS-50, I think we had 3 aircraft, you know, and then gradually, you know, we built up. So for the first year, flying was sort of at a minimum, and in fact, I volunteered to go and stand duty in my old squadron, the training squadron, for, you know, for search and rescue and so on and so forth, to get more flying time. Because as a young pilot, you're very interested to get that logbook built up, and, you know, you appreciate any additional flying that you can get. I don't know what else. I was there for 4 years in HS-50, and the progression was, as I said, initially as a co-pilot in the Sea King, and then built up there to aircraft captain. Initially, the deployments at sea were aboard HMTS Bonaventure, the aircraft carrier, and then during those 4 years, we just started to become operational with the DDH, with the helicopters on the destroyers, and in fact, I was involved in the very first detachment that was operational in that. So it was a very interesting time, you know, and a great variety of things to do, and most of them were new, you know, so very much sort of the pioneering that spirit was in existence, you know.
Can you describe your experience with being the first pilot off the destroyer, flying off the destroyer from here?
Well, I wasn't the first pilot to fly off. Yeah, the concept started, and it was given to VX-10, our experimental and test and evaluation squadron, to develop the procedures, and so they would do the initial acceptance of the aircraft. The first three or four airframes came from the United States, and then they were built in Canada. And so they would test the aircraft and make sure that they're, airworthy from the manufacturer. But they also developed and tested and evaluated the concept, both equipment and the procedures of how to fly and operate off the destroyers. And once they had finished those trials, and they went in phases over many years, and subsequent, when we did the night phase at sea, I in fact was in the X-10 and did a lot of the night trials, but at that stage, I'm now talking 64 to 68, my first tuning is 50, our operations on the destroyers were restricted to daytime and very limited ship motion conditions. And it was naturally, it was the start of the concept. We didn't really know how far we could go and what we could do. So it was, when I went to sea in the first detachment, it actually happened in 1967, centennial year. And the first couple of months were not really all that operational because we were part of the centennial celebration, and we sailed up the St. Lawrence River to Quebec City, Montreal, where there's Expo and so we were more a show and tell than an operational deployment. But it was interesting and fascinating, not so much from the flying aspect, but one of the things that VX-10, of course, did not focus on was the organization and the organizational relationships with the ship and so on and so forth. And this is what we had to develop in HS-50. I mean, VX-10, the test pods told us, this is the altitude you should hover, this is how you should land, this is how you should do this and that. But how you interacted with your colleagues on the ship in terms of integrating as an operational unit with the ship, and also in other relationships in terms of responsibilities, and you sort of coming aboard, you're part of the ship, and you certainly answer to the ship's captain in the sense that he has operational command over things. On the other hand, he's had nothing to do with your preparations and readiness and all that sort of stuff, which you're responsible to the parent squadron and the air side of the world. And so how the two would meet and mate was totally new, and it was something that till the day I retired was always still being adjusted as the overall organization of the Canadian Forces changed. When we first started, of course, it was the Royal Canadian Navy. This was all Navy people, naval personnel, and in that regard, it was somewhat simpler because the education could take place at a much lower level, and you're all naval personnel, and so you could understand the chain of command and all that. Subsequent to 1967, when integration and unification took place, and certainly after that, when actually an Air Force was re-established with Air Command, the thing became more difficult and more complex in some ways, this organizational relationship, because it was now more the Air Force putting some of their people on board a ship, and there was some reluctance by some of these people who had never been to sea, had no sort of naval culture, to accept that their they're integral to the ship. They were quite prepared to fly and operate the helicopters, but they, many of them didn't want to sort of really integrate. And, so that always became a challenge. It still is a challenge, and it certainly has changed from that first tour when we started in, you know, 64 to 68.
Do you find that the pilots stick together aboard ship, or the flying personnel?
Well, again, this is some of the things that had changed over the years. Back when we started, because we're all you know, there was certainly always a bit of a rivalry between us and the fish heads, as we call them. But on the other hand, in most ships, you certainly were integral. You're such a small unit that you can't really sort of operate separately. On the aircraft carrier, the first 2 years when I deployed at sea was on the aircraft carrier. There was definitely, it was the air crew and the fixed wing and the helicopter. They were sort of a big group. And then there was the ship's personnel, and we didn't really blend in all that well. But that was another change. Unlike the destroyers, where we had to integrate more because we were so much more of the ship in terms of its weapon system, its operational capability. And the aircraft carrier, it was a platform that had air squadrons aboard, and the air squadrons operated. Well, it's on their own, so it wasn't integral to the ship. The ship was more or less there just to carry the air squad. Whereas in the DDH concept, the aircraft is very much totally integral in the operational capability of the ship, and therefore it demands more of an integration. And so in the first couple of years, my first tour there, the destroyers were very well integrated, and I think you didn't keep to yourself as aircrew. You were part of it, but of course there was an affinity because you get work with these people, every day all the time. I guess there was a bit more closeness with the aircrew than the ship, but generally was very integrated. Subsequently, after integration and so on, when we had more and more people and almost the new generations who had no shipboard experience at all before coming to the Sea King one, it very much isolated itself. These were now, just detachments that were plunked on the ships, and there was much less integration with the ship's personnel, and we stuck very much more on the air side together, and sometimes actually there was a lot of friction and animosity. Why some of us looked fondly at the old days when we were all naval personnel, because we think we understood each other better. And
which one did you like serving aboard better, the destroyer or the aircraft carrier, in relation to the camaraderie that was like aboard ship?
Difficult to say. They were different, okay? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I really enjoyed about the aircraft carrier was that... Oh, my glass, it just broke up. If you're talking about naval aviation, you cannot sort of think of anything except aircraft carriers initially, okay? And in fact, those that flew on aircraft carriers at the same time that we had the destroyer concept, they felt that true naval aviation was just carrier-borne aviation, and that this other aspect was not really true naval aviation. And having said that, certainly from a helicopter point of view, it was much more challenging and demanding to fly off the destroyers to land a Sea King on the aircraft carrier was you know, not, I mean, it was demanding in the sense that you had a lot of bad weather and all that sort of stuff, but you can have bad weather ashore too, and so on. Yes, the ship moved a bit, but it was not terribly difficult. Now, having landed a jet from a small aircraft carrier like Bonaventure, that was challenging. So that's why that aspect of that sort of special uniqueness that we're, you know, the greatest aviators were sort of more restricted to the fixed wing carrier world, that it was some reluctance in terms of camaraderie and all that, just that they accept that those that, you know, flew off destroyers were also true naval aviators. So certainly when I was flying off Bonaventure, in terms of personal pilot demands and so on and so forth, it wasn't as great as subsequently in the destroyers, but that atmosphere of naval aviation was certainly much more pronounced there, because you had such a larger concentration of naval aviators, whereas if you just had one helicopter and a destroyer, you know, you're a small group and that sort of stuff. So yeah, it changed, but it's hard to say which I prefer. You know, from my looking back on it, I'm glad I had the carrier experience, but because I was so involved in the development of the destroyer program, you know, I feel a closer affinity with that.
And where were your other postings after Shearwater?
Okay. Well, after Shearwater, I went after the first squadron posting from 64 to 68, which is 50. I was posted to the Extend, as I mentioned earlier, which is another flying posting, but in the test flying world. And what I mostly did there was, in fact, the second or last phase of the development of the DDH program, which was the night and heavy weather operations. And we tested more equipment and established more procedures. And during that time, we cleared the whole Seeking DDH concept for unrestricted day-night operations. A number of equipments and things like that that I evaluated at the time. We also looked at a complete modernization of the Seeking, which was another one of my projects there. So that was, you know, very interesting and very influential time through those 2 years. Subsequent to those 2 years, I stayed in Halifax, living in Shearwater, but was on the staff of sea training staff, and that was a team of all disciplines of naval warfare, you know, from engineering, and so they would train a ship, a whole ship, in terms of getting ready for combat, and I was responsible for the air side of it. So although it wasn't a specific flying job, I did do some flying, and I certainly involved myself very much in the further development of the integration of the helicopter in the combat system of the ship. Oh, after that, so that brings me to 70 to 72. 72, I was selected to be the first on a helicopter exchange program with the United States Navy that involved destroyers. The U.S. Navy was just starting at the time, so actually they were behind us in using helicopters on small boats, small ships, destroyers, frigates, in the general warfare thing. Up until that point, This is during the Vietnam era. The only time they had helicopters on destroyers and smaller ships was in the Gulf of Tonkin in combat search and rescue and things like that. So I was sent to San Diego to help with the U.S. and with the development of an integrated helicopter in the destroyer concept, much like we had done. And I was there. I flew a different helicopter there, the Sea Sprites, and the Cayman H2F Sea Sprite. And then I deployed with the U.S. and to Vietnam just at the end of the Vietnam War. That was interesting too, because I could see a different approach, and it was very interesting. We did a lot of flying, but a lot more actual sort of operations. At that time, Canada and Canadian Navy, we did a lot of exercise, a lot of Cold War issues, but there was no active wars or operations going on, whereas with the U.S. and, of course, with the Vietnam War, there were. And so it was, for me, a very interesting approach to things, and I was very happy to have experienced that. So that was 3 years there. Then I went to Staff College and then 3 years in Ottawa in the Director of Maritime Aviation, where I was overseeing the Sea King and its replacement, starting the paperwork for its replacement from the national headquarters point of view. But so it was a non-flying position there. I don't know if that, trying to remember the original question was...
Oh, that's fine. It was just where
you're
at the coaching.
Yeah, well, so Ottawa till 1980, and then I went back to Shearwater. By this time, HS-50 had split into two operational helicopter squadrons, HS-423 and HS-443, and I was appointed to HS-423, and went back to flying at sea operationally off destroyers for 2 years, I think, maybe two or 3 years. And then, yes, 3 years, 80 to 83, and then in 83 I was appointed in command of HD-406, which is the operational training squadron at Shearwater, which teaches all people how to fly and operate the Sea King. Because when pilots now come to the Sea King, well, they don't necessarily fly. They may have helicopter experience, but they may have flown all sorts of different aircraft, and same with the rest of the air crew, the navigators and the air crewmen may not have specific seeking experience. So that squadron, HD-406, checked them out in the aircraft and taught them all the fundamentals of how to operate the seeking. And I did that for 3 years, and then I was posted out here to Victoria on the staff of the Maritime Command of the Pacific as Deputy Chief of Operations Air. So I was in a broader position. We looked after all air operations on the West Coast, fixed wing as well as the helicopters. And at that time, the helicopters, during that time I was there, we brought a squadron of Seekings out from Shearwater to Pat Bay, to the airport. So that was interesting time in that aspect. But other than that, I wasn't actually flying the Seekings there. I think I only got one flight in those 3 years. And they made me sit in the back in the passenger. But anyhow, so I was out here till from 86 to 90. Yeah, the last year I was in French course out here. And then I was posted to Europe to come back to back two tours with NATO. It had absolutely nothing to do with anything I ever did before. And there was no flying, and in fact my first tour was at the Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, where I was in charge of war headquarters training. So it was really an army sort of responsibility as to how to man the NATO headquarters and operate them in time of war. That's interesting. And from there I went to Brussels to NATO headquarters there, again in a totally unrelated to flying a job where I worked with Eastern European countries in the post-Soviet area, and trying to bring them together with NATO and to pursue common goals of peacekeeping, search and rescue, and things like that. And then from there I retired.
Did the operation differ very much from Shearwater to Pat Bay? Was how the bases were run or how everything was run, was it quite different or was it quite...
No, the actual flying at the squadron level was still all very much controlled and dictated by the East Coast, okay? Although it was actually a squadron here, it was very much like a detachment, because all the resources, whether it was aircraft or it was people and so forth, were all on the East Coast at Shearwater. So so from the aircrew point of view, you were out here, stationed here, you had your family and everything else with you, but you often had to go back. The simulator was at Shearwater, all the coursing, the upgrade. It's not a one-time thing, the training. The training is continuous, and whether you advance in your status from co-pilot to aircraft captain to crew commander, there's qualifications and things like that to be done. Plus there's, repeat survival schools and this and that. There's always sort of requirements to continue your training. And nearly all of those things were only available on the East Coast. So at the squadron level, it was, except if you traveled more across the country, it was much the same as it was at Shearwater, it's just that you were here. But at the higher level, in terms of command and control of the whole squadron resources, this was now adding a new dimension of complexity, and that you had the command structure here that you were sort of working with directly, yet on paper you were responsible to all the people that were 4,000 miles away, and that was complex and required quite a bit of fine-tuning and an innovative way of dealing with it. And I just last week met with the chief of operations here in Markback now, where we went over how it is now, and I can see from my time there till now that there's been so much change and that this thing has evolved. But at the squadron level, it's really just like a detachment deployed. The aircraft pool is managed and controlled at Shearwater. Mm-hmm. I think that's that question.
From all the aircraft that you flew, was there one that was your favorite or had more advantages than the others?
Well, overall, I guess I think my aircraft is the Seeking, and one aspect is that I have the most hours in it than any other aircraft. Secondly, I was involved right from the beginning when Canada acquired it. I was involved in various modernization programs and developments, and had a personal hand in a lot of that stuff. So it's no doubt my favorite aircraft in that regard. Having said that, when I flew the USN and the H-2 Sea Sprite, it was, from a pilot's point of view, it was quite a different control system. It was a very unconventional control system for helicopters, which has advantages and drawback, but the end result was that it was quite a sports car. It was much more, it was a small aircraft, but it had just as much power as the Seeking, and so it was fun to fly. But overall, as a system, and so it wasn't as good as the Seeking. So, yeah, my favorite aircraft was the Seeking.
And aboard the Seeking, how many people were in the crew?
Four. Pilot, co-pilot, a navigator, and a sensor operator. Now, when we first started, we also had a crew of four, but it was two pilots, pilot and co-pilot, no navigator, but two sonar operators. Because initially, when we got Seeking, all it had in terms of tactical equipment was a sonar. No radar, no electronic navigation system or anything else. So the co-pilot was the navigator, and the two sonar operators just relieved each other, because if you're pinging for 4 hours or so, you need to be relieved in order to stay sharp. And then later on, with modernization of the Seeking, we got more equipment. We got radar, we got other equipment in it, and so we just had one sensor operator and a navigator in the back.
Can you explain what's involved with the anti-submarine warfare? That's a big question.
It is a very big question. Well, it's a specialization or a section, really, of naval warfare. When you consider sort of the historic book at naval warfare, before the First World War, it was ships versus ships, surface ships versus surface ships, okay? And that's when you had the build-up of the dreadnoughts, and you built bigger ships with bigger guns, so you could, with longer range, sink smaller ones and so on. And that was, and of course, when the submarine came about, which is sort of the First World War, it changed that, and that a relatively small, relatively inexpensive vessel could do a lot of damage and was very cost effective in warfare. And of course, from that time on, the submarine developed all the way to strategic nuclear ballistic missile submarines, and so in terms of warfare, you couldn't just ignore that, and we know that in many ways, especially during the Second World War, where the German U-boats did so much damage in terms of the shipping in the Atlantic and other places, that you had to take active measures to counter that threat. And that's basically the specialization that he wants, is how to counter the submarine threat is ASW. Now, ASW does not just mean aircraft, it's obviously ships, and ships are very much equipped with anti-submarine, and some ships, and that was given to the Canadian Navy sort of at the end of World War II, partially because of the amount of convoy work we did. And personally, we took it upon ourselves to specialize as a whole Navy in anti-submarine warfare, and that just gradually diminished as the threat changed, and for us to be more general purpose now in, you know, maybe the last 20 years or so. But certainly the destroyers and the TBHs of the 60s and 70s were all principally anti-submarine warfare vessels, and that the helicopter was mainly at that time acquired and the whole system developed to enhance the anti-submarine effectiveness of it. When we first started, we had some utility things. We could take the Patrick from one ship to the other for church service. We could deliver movies and mail. But the main tactical purpose was anti-submarine warfare. And when we first got to the Sea King and so forth. So when you ask ASW, it's broad. It's submarines against submarines. It's underwater surveillance systems, fixed, you know, arrays on the ocean floor. That's part of anti-submarine warfare.
Yeah.
It's not just, you know, naval aviation. I mean, it's very, very broad and complex. And yeah. But from our point of view, we initially started our main tactical, our operational purpose was anti-submarine warfare, and it's just more in the later stages of the Sea King, for example, where we added equipment, for example, from Somalia and the Gulf War, where we put more surface surveillance equipment in infrared and well, we had the radar initially mainly for shipboard and I mean for ASW and our own shipboard recovery reasons, but now we're, you know, doing a lot more surface warfare as well as anti-submarine warfare.
In your opinion, what do you believe is the most important aspect of naval aviation?
I don't know how to answer that. One would have to start by defining naval aviation first, okay?
Okay.
Now, there's there'll be many that say that there is no such thing as naval aviation in Canada anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be quite correct in that, okay? And I think I've sort of mentioned it peripherally as I went along. When we started, all of us joined the Navy and the aviation part was sort of a specialization. Okay, we're naval officers first, and naval personnel first, and then secondly we're pilots. And initially when I joined, it's just that I went into the integration right away. I would have, after my first flying tour, I would have expected to go to a ship and be a ship's officer, you know, the deck officer or assistant weapons officer or something like that, before I would go back perhaps to another flying tour, and some never went back. So naval aviation had a certain definition at the time, that you were part of this group that specialized in aviation, but you were within the Navy. Subsequent to unification, this gradually diminished, and there were just a few of those that started that way left in the system, you know, like myself, and gradually more and more came from outside the naval environment, people that were not trained as naval officers or naval personnel first. And therefore, it begs the question, are they naval aviators? They're operated at sea. You know, some people might say a naval aviator is somebody who operates at sea. I don't think you can just say that, because in fact, a lot of people are quite foreign to sort of the maritime warfare aspect when they come to there, and they just basically fly a helicopter. You know, and yes, they have to learn to fly aboard ship, but the whole concept of naval warfare is not, you know, a long-standing trained specialization that they have. So it's hard to say. Now, in my opinion, we served the Navy better when we had naval personnel flying, because as I mentioned, you were part of this group, so your whole training, upbringing, promotion, everything was within that concept, and you understood the aspect of maritime warfare much better than, you know, now where we sort of have people, you know, you're a pilot, okay, you're a helicopter pilot, you fly for the Army, you get specialized in how to do the map of the earth flying, and so the next posting is to the Navy and Sea Kings, and all of a sudden whatever you experience and learn is almost of no use, you know, in terms of refactoring. Sure, any experience is good, being a better pilot, but now you're not flying much more instrument, whereas in the Army you didn't fly any except once a year to get your ticket, and so on and so forth. So it's quite different. So what it really begs the question whether we still have a naval aviation. And I look at it more that it's a historic thing, you know, that these new people aren't really naval aviators by any definition, except that they actually, for one tour or two tours, operate at sea. Now, some of those that are there now want to be called naval aviators, and I don't want to deny them that. If they make a career of it, they're probably as interested and as dedicated as we were. But it's, you know, as a term, naval aviation, it sort of begs the question whether we really have that still in Canada.
So if you look at historical aspect, then what was the most important idea behind that?
Well, I think the most important idea behind it is that you have people that fully understand the challenge of warfare at sea, okay? And I don't think if we would not have had naval people interested in that, we would have developed the whole operation as we did, the DDH concept, and even our time on the carrier, we were, you know, very good how we used to see them. We're not the only ones, you know, the Americans had aircraft like that on the carriers and the helicopters and so forth, and the Brits and others too. So, you know, but we refined the way we did it, but especially the DDH Council, which Canada sort of led and pioneered, would not have happened if we would not have had people that understood the Navy and the challenge and the task that the Navy had in the broad sense, to show how if we integrate an aircraft capability with the destroyers, how we would, you know, gain that. I mean, you could have naval personnel order that, but if you don't have naval people, you know, be innovative and find ways to do it, if you have somebody who has no real understanding of it, I don't think we ever would have gotten there. So I think historically it has huge impact, and I would think that if we were to require another sort of innovative use of something or other that is new, we don't have naval personnel or people that are really involved with the concept of war at sea, you just wouldn't get it. So I think it was very significant.
And how would you describe your role as a naval AVA during the post-war period?
Naval aviator, I think, again, I alluded to it. I was initially in that first group that was fully instrument trained, you know, brand new pilots that were proficient in instrument flying. And so I actually found myself as a very young greenhorn pilot that not only had more experience but more confidence in flying at night and instruments in the helicopter, because I had, you know, to me, right from the first start of training, instrument flying was part of flying. Whereas when I came to the Navy helicopter squadron, as I said before, most of the pilots who were there had flown helicopters for a number of years, but never instruments. They didn't have a current green ticket, as we call it at the time. And so one of the interesting things is I remember one pilot, he was a very good pilot, he was one of the senior pilots in the squadron, and I was just, you know, the new co-pilot. And every time I was flying with him, if it was a clear day, we just enjoyed it, and he said, you know, isn't this beautiful, these sea kings, you know, because they were, it's the first year or so that we had it, and we were amazing, because it was a technological huge leap from the HF4S to the sea king. It was turbine powered, it was sort of autopilot features, and lots of, I mean, there was just a huge generational technological leap from one to the other. So it was, you know, you still sort of enjoyed this brand new shiny toy. But every time if the clouds came in or something, and here we were flying, and he said, feel that vibration, man? And in three consecutive flights with this pilot, every time there was a cloud, we did an emergency landing, because he thought there was something wrong. And it was just that he wasn't confident and wasn't experienced with flying instruments. To me, I didn't notice any difference from, you know, clear sky to flying in cloud, but to him, all of a sudden he became apprehensive. So my first sort of experience was that I was, you know, in the first group, it was nothing that I individually did, but it was the new generation that was in some ways more professional of a helicopter pilot, in the sense that we didn't carry, you know, any of these inhibitions that helicopters shouldn't fly more than a few hundred feet. You know, I mean, this is the other thing. I remember flying when we, in VX-10, when the aircraft were being built and overhauled in Montreal and Saint-Hubert, and I would ferry them back to Shearwater, and I would go and file an instrument flight plan, and air traffic control was not used to helicopters, and they would just see Navy 3-6, you know, and they'd say, helicopter, what are you doing at 8,000 feet, you know, and then they'd have fun and say, well, I can give you a better altitude if you climb vertically, you know. But this is all sort of fairly new, and then that helicopters would fly instruments. So that was the first thing. Then my impact was, I think, quite significant during my VX-10 time, when I was very much involved in the clearance for service use, as we call it, for unrestricted day-night heavy weather operations. And the significance of that, we allowed ship operations with up to 31 degrees of roll, 9 degrees of pitch. We're unique in the world. The closest game was 5 degrees of roll and 1 degree of pitch. I mean, we were just so far ahead in this development, and we did it, and we were safe in doing it. We didn't just wildly, you know, to be bigger and better than the other guy. So I think my involvement there was quite instrumental in the development of the DEH concept. And then after my USN exchange, when I was in Ottawa, my specific job was to start the process for the replacement of the Sea King, and I initiated the first statement of requirements for the replacement, and where, you know, with the benefit of my experience with the U.S. and so on and so forth, I think I was, you know, my work had quite an impact on the replacement thing. Having said that, a lot of that, of course, was wasted in that, you know, year 76, but now, 30 years later, we still don't have the replacement. So what I had initially worked on has been, you know, replaced and amended and changed. I mean, since then, so much more has gone into development. And it's just right now that the contract is left for its replacement. We hope to see first aircraft in 2008.
What was your most memorable moment during your flying time, or any time that you served at all?
Hard to say most memorable. You know, there's a few things that stand out. And, one flight, when I was in the X-10, we decided to establish a Canadian altitude record. So it flew over 20,000 feet, and for a while that was sort of the trivial pursuit questions and the various schools and stuff like that. I guess one of the other most memorable things is when at sea my controls locked, and I felt, you know, I was a goner, and then somehow we managed to pull out of that. So it's hard to say what is most memorable. When you fly for that long, they have so many experiences, and with the USN, they had some fantastically interesting flights and operations with airships and helicopters. It's hard to pick up one.
And what, in your opinion, was your most important mission?
Most important mission? In terms of a flight?
Yes. Yeah.
Or in terms of an appointment? Or?
Either one. Whatever you believe is your most important flight.
A flight normally is up to 4 hours or so. Some of them are longer. So I don't think you can pick one out of, you know, there are 4,000 hours seeking time, so you can pick one out of those. In terms of most important overall mission, is, in my opinion, there was no doubt the VX-10 time. You know, where we did a lot of stuff, introduced some stuff, invented some stuff, designed some stuff, tested it, and brought it into service use that is now in use, that is now being exported to other countries, is, you know, saying so. It is certainly the VX-10 time, I think, most important, in fact.
And once you retired from the service, did you ever fly as a hobby?
Only one flight. A couple of reasons. Can't afford it.
Yeah.
And I was looking at a retirement, you know. We, at that time, had to retire quite early, at age 55. So I was definitely looking at doing something in retirement other than play golf. And my wife wanted me very much to look for an aviation-related job, because she knew I liked flying so much. And so, but I deliberately chose not to, and the main reason was that I enjoyed flying very much, and I enjoyed pushing the envelope when I, you know, throughout my time. But also, I felt that you know, as you get older, everything from vision to reflexes and all that sort of diminished. And as a hobby, I would love to fly if I could afford it, because then you don't have the pressure of, you know, of bottom line. But I just felt if I were to get, you know, a job as a helicopter pilot or even as a fixed-wing pilot, they fixed wing weren't all that available anyhow. Helicopters could have gone up north or something, but the pressures of, you know, pushing the envelope, and at my age, I said, no, I survived. This point, I'm not going to push it. And then, actually, a couple years into retirement, I had a heart attack, and then I couldn't, you know, legally fly anymore. I couldn't pass the medical.
And do you list any decorations or awards that you received during your time of service or after?
What was the first question?
Any decorations or awards?
Oh, yes.
Can you list the ones that you have received?
Yes. I received the Order of Military Merit in 1975. So this was, you know, fairly shortly after the order was established. So I think that's something that I'm quite proud of. You know, besides the regular ones of, you know, long service and all that sort of stuff, I also was given the award, it's called the Award in Gold for Service for the Republic of Austria. And which is actually quite, and that was for my NATO work, where I did quite a bit. That's sort of the two most significant ones, yeah. And then, as I say, the other ones are long service, Jubilee, that you happen to be at the right time. And, you know, you were on a merit list high enough to get it. And so not that specifically, but those two were, you know, very personal, very individual. I also got some almost routine things that they hand out in my later time from Poland, from Hungary. But if you were the liaison officer with them or Gaza, they always thought they had to give you some kind of honor at the end. They don't mean that much to me because, you know, it was sort of done more routine. But the one from Austria is one of the highest ones that they can give to, you know, non-Austrian citizens. So I was quite proud of that. And of course, the Canadian Order of Military Merit is one of our highest ones too, so it's good about that too.
Well, thank you very much for being part of the UVic project here and part with in correspondence with Rusi as well. Is there any last thing that you would like to add to anything that you believe I might have missed or anything?
I don't think so. Maybe I can use these. No, I think we certainly have covered that, and a couple of, you know, questions were actually quite interesting in that it's sort of, you know, they weren't answerable in a short way, so, you know, I found it interesting that from somebody who wasn't involved, and actually just to say, you know, there was, you know, what is the role of naval air? And yeah, so it's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.